Welcome to Inspiring Stories for Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Hello, my name is Tim McMillan. Welcome to another episode of Inspiring Stories brought to you by Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. There were plenty of huge moments in my next guest's career. It's fair to say he's one of the absolute legends of Australian and world cricket, a man who rewrote the rule book and the style guide for the role of wicketkeeper batsman. And when it came to being a clean striker of the ball, there are only really a few who I reckon could match him. And if you want to disappear down a rabbit hole for a few hours on YouTube, punch this man's name into your search and away you go. I know that I've certainly done that. It's a great way to spend a few hours, though, especially if you are a cricket tragic. So it's with great pleasure I say hello and welcome to Adam Gilchrist. How are you?
Hey, Tim. Yeah, really good. Thank you. Very good. Don't search for my Gangnam-style dancing on YouTube.
Oh, really? Funnily enough, I did not put all those words together in the one search, but you know now that I will.
Not my proudest moment and the one that my kids continue to rib me about. But anyway, it was celebrating my only wicket in competitive cricket.
Yeah, right. So, well, bowling is something we haven't seen you do much of. But I must say, in my YouTube rabbit hole adventures, I did come across a clip where you did send a few deliveries down to Glenn McGrath in a recent promotional video that you did.
Yeah.
And you can roll the arm over a bit, can't you?
Well, where I actually reckon I really hit a groove there was when I got on the ball machine.
Oh, yeah.
And just while McGrath wasn't looking, I cranked it up to about 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And
that was the end of it.
Sent one through. Yeah, that was the end of the net session. McGrath spat it. Came out hurling abuse.
It was a quick end. Faster than he ever was.
Absolutely. Twice as quick as McGrath. Rubbish.
As you look back on your career, though, it's funny, you know, I don't know if you have ever YouTubed yourself, though. It obviously brings up your highlights in an order that the fans will have appreciated in searching for you. But the highlights for you, I'm wondering if they match up with the highlights as dictated by, you know, your fans on the internet. I'll say that your 57 ball ton at the Wacker is right up there.
Yep.
Your final one day innings is right up there.
Yeah. I think I understand why, say, if the Wacker 100 would be a fan favourite. It was exciting and entertaining and all happened very quickly, didn't it? But and it's probably one of the most asked about innings of my career.
Yeah.
It's probably the one that people most often bring up. But but no, my highlights don't quite match the ones on the YouTube sort of feature list. 49 in the second innings in Chennai in 2004. I don't think you'll find highlights of that on YouTube, but it was probably my favourite innings.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Just the situation we were in, the match scenario, what we were trying to do. We were really on the back foot against India in India. It can be very challenging. So I was captain at the time, so I thought we needed to try to be really aggressive. We had given up a first innings deficit or lead, and we needed to try to make inroads into their lead as quickly as we can, I thought, just to try to get some momentum back. So I slotted myself up to number three, self-indulgently, but I thought if I miss out by being aggressive, at least we've got our main batting unit behind me to sort of shore it up. Again, it wasn't a huge innings, but it was 49 in pretty quick time and it got us back to parity. And fortunately, Damien Martin dug in then the next day with Jason Gillespie as a pretty good ally as night watchman. And we went on. We drew the game. The last day got washed out. But just felt like it was a really nice momentum swing in that match and in that series and then allowed us to go on and achieve a series win for the first time in a long time in India. So that one and 100 against Bangladesh and everyone says, oh, come on, mate, that's just cashing in. You know, everyone fills their boots against Bangladesh. But it was in Bangladesh and it was probably the most important 100 that I scored for Australia in staving off a loss and turning it around into a victory.
Because that would have been a headline.
That would have been a reasonable headline at the time. We hadn't been beaten by Bangladesh in Test cricket at that stage. So,
you don't want to be amongst the first.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Let's go back to your very early days. You are a New South Welshman, by birth and growing up there. Your early memories when you really started to fall in love with the game of cricket? What can you remember?
Youngest of four kids. Yep. To parents that were both teachers, but they were very sporty, and Dad played a great deal of cricket. He loved his cricket, and as did my older siblings. Even the eldest sibling, my sister Jackie, played men's cricket in regional New South Wales because there were no women's teams around. So she just played B-grade men's in Deniliquin down in the Southern Riverina. And so I was always around cricket. But my first clear memory of it was Dad used to play for a team called Lake Albert in Wagga Wagga down in Southern New South Wales. And going with him and just sort of being around the men's game there and sort of watching them warm up, or going in and sitting in the change rooms in the corner and, you know, listening to them. And then when they'd all go out to play, just ratting through their kit bags and just picking up bats and hitting the ball and looking at a protector or a box and going, I wonder what that's for.
Finding out and still wondering what it was.
Realising I was in the wrong spot. But, the sounds, the smells, the noises of cricket, that's probably...
The lunches.
All that. And sitting... Dad going out to bat, so the rest of the team have to babysit me, and that was never long. He was a wily old leg spinner, but he didn't wield the willow too well. But that was all of first recollection. So that was early primary school years, even younger. Yeah.
What about the heroes that you would have seen on the sporting field at the time that you really looked up to?
Pretty much any of them that were on TV. I thought that looked pretty abnormal. They looked sort of didn't look real. So that late 70s, sort of early 80s era, but was going to be the fast. I was going to be the fastest bowler in the world on the back of sort of Dennis Lilly. So that was in the background. Used to do that. Used to water the grass a little bit and then run in on the run-up and try to get the footmarks, you know, in the run-up, like that you see on TV, if it's been worn out over about 100 overs. But then went shopping in Shepparton, the town of Shepparton in northern Victoria. That was the Big Smoke from Deniliquin.
Yeah.
We used to drive down there and saw a pair of green and white wicket-keeping gloves.
So how old would you have been then?
That was when I was 9.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with wicket-keeping there.
So
Rod Marsh became a bit of a magnet for me when I was watching cricket. I was just looking at him all the time and just fell in love with it then and just loved being involved in pretty much every ball of every day's play when you're the wicket-keeper, certainly when you're in the field. So, they were all the heroes, really, just the guys on TV.
And your junior days, you know, if you put your hand up for the wicket keeper, it's a niche job, isn't it?
I
remember, you know, being in teams that age myself, and you know, you had those who reluctantly took it on, and those who were like, bugger off, gloves are mine,
I want
don't
it.
Even think about it.
Yeah,
were you that guy?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, even though I had a tough start, my first game that I actually wicket kept, I was filling in for one of my older brother's team, and the ball came in and hit the edge of the cement pitch. Was sitting about 2 or 3 inches higher than the grass. It hadn't been laid very well. And it took a nasty deflection and cannon into my nose, broke my nose. So off to hospital, overnight in hospital at that age was, a bit challenging. And a nurse, a very, very thoughtful nurse, let me know that Rod Marsh suffered the same injury the first time he ever wicket kept. So from that moment on, I thought that was destiny.
Exactly.
That's where I was headed. And I actually met Rod Marsh. He was the head coach at the Cricket Academy when I went there when I was first year out of school on a scholarship, and asked him about that, and he said he'd never broken his nose ever.
There you go.
So it was a very, very well-meaning...
A destiny based on a lie.
Well, on a lie, but go back to the nurse. And I think, done to the nurse, because that cheered me up no end, being in hospital overnight, thinking that I was off and running.
Hey, we need to take a break, Gilly. After that, we might fast forward to when you were lured over here to the West, which was an interesting time. Let me tell you, we'll get into that in detail right if we take a break. Adam Gilchrist is our special guest on this episode of Inspiring Stories. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. My guest in this episode, a man with many accomplishments and accolades I could reel off, but the first player to hit 100 sixes in Test Match cricket. That'll be right up there on your list of personal achievements, wouldn't it, Gilly? Yeah, three World Cups to your name as well.
Yeah, I think that when you reflect on the achievements, it's all the team stuff. So three World Cups in a row.
Yeah.
And the second two undefeated. Not sure that's going to be matched for a while,
no.
But it's a pretty significant group. And twice we won 16 Test matches in a row.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's going
to
be...
And you were captain through some of those.
Through a couple of them, yeah.
Yeah.
But, they were really, amazing play group.
Oh.
That people say,
a freakishly good group.
How did you guys maintain it for so long? I think we had strong leadership, from John Buchanan's coach and the leaders, the captains and the senior player. But we at the end of the day, we had six or seven Hall of Fame cricketers in the one team consistently for the best part of 10 years.
Yeah.
That's not a bad nucleus to start with and then build around it with a few other guys that are pretty close to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Let's go back now to your early days and when you first came over to Western Australia. How were things? Obviously, you're playing cricket in New South Wales then, but looking for opportunities, one came up over here in the West. Can you talk us through how all that played out?
Yeah, made it into the New South Wales team, sort of out of the Creed Academy, went to Sydney and played my grade cricket and second 11 cricket. And then I got picked in the New South Wales team as a batsman and Phil Emery was a wicketkeeper.
Yep.
And that's not a name a lot of people know, but if you look at Ian Healy's career, I think it was 117 test matches, only missed one test match, Heels, at about the halfway point of those tests.
Yeah.
And it was Phil Emery who they called on to replace or to fill in for him when he was injured. So he was right up there, played a test match.
Mm.
So I needed to look elsewhere. I wanted to wicketkeep. And I guess I looked over here, Tim Zura, a guy that I thought was a champion, because just as I say, he'd been on TV, he'd played for Australia, he was a hero of mine.
Yeah.
And he was getting towards the end of his career. I didn't know how close, but I thought there might be an opportunity here. And WA did approach me and say, come and join the squad without any real certain promise of getting picked or anything. So I was happy to take that punt, just take a risk and come over. I guess I expected or hoped that I'd play a year of club cricket, second 11 cricket, train with under Tim. Should he retire at the end of that first year, maybe I'd be the guy that they go to be the permanent spot in the Shield team.
Yep.
I got here and they sacked him straight away and put me in.
Yeah.
And, much to the disappointment of the locals, very parochial crowd over here,
It was. I remember being at your first game for WA.
Yeah.
And when you walked out and people were chanting, Zura, Zura, Zura.
Yeah, I got booed and
which was
all the way
in hindsight.
On.
But you were kind of cast as this villain in many respects, weren't you?
Yeah.
Quite unfairly,
but
of course.
I got it.
Like
he
was this lovable, rogue sort of character.
He was a crowd favourite, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He had so much character and he's such a talent.
Yeah.
And played good footy as well and born and bred. And
And
I think too, a lot of the WA faithful who were his supporters felt he'd been cast aside easily at the Australian level.
Exactly.
So Heels used to cop it when he used to come here, Ian Healy.
Yeah.
So for me to be turning up some unknown New South Welsh kid, I got it. I understood it. So I think
But what was that like though, going out and hearing this other guy's name being chanted in this kind of act of hostility towards you?
I remember that. Second or third game being in the middle of the whacker and a little kid waving to me. I thought, oh, beautiful. I finally won one over. I turned around as I waved back, he yelled out, Gilchrist, go home. So I thought, but I think it helped inspire me just to work hard. And what I realised was I'm not going to be Tim Zura. I'm not going to be a ready-made replacement for the fans, the hero that they had there. But it certainly inspired me to work hard to try to get my game to a level that justified being there and then just try to earn the fan and my peers in the change room and the squad. I wanted to earn their respect. So I think that's the main thing. I didn't feel any animosity from them. I understand that sport.
Yeah.
And, I just had to try to prove that I belong there.
Yeah.
And fortunately, it changed around pretty quick. I had great support from the Whacker.
Yep.
It was an interesting year. I mean, the WACA just part of, I think, what enhanced that whole attention and the microscope on it was that we were just renamed the Western Warriors rather than this WA. You know, all this branding and new marketing came out. Damien Martin became captain when, you know, Tom Moody might have been the obvious choice, or Mike Valletta, or even Bruce Rhee, like one of the older players, because Jeff Marsh retired. So it was this real push for youth. And I did know Marto really well from under 19 cricket, but there was some uncertainty around whether that was the right move. So it was, yeah, it was a turbulent time. But I guess, as I say, I was well supported by the WACA, and then pretty quickly it turned around, and I've had nothing but great support from the WACA crowd ever since.
Making runs and taking catches wins the crowd over pretty quickly.
That's the way, it's the only currency really you can do it.
Yeah.
And that remains to in this day and age.
Yeah.
Don't worry about everything else. Just produce the goods, and hopefully you'll be looked after.
What about in terms of just general life here in Perth and in WA? How quickly did you take to it?
Loved it. Loved it right from the moment.
Yeah.
I got over here. I was in a relationship with my now wife, but we weren't married at the time, Mel.
Yeah.
She was in Sydney. So that was a bit of a challenge. She was still studying in Sydney. But, you know, between going over to New South Wales for Shield games or in university holidays, Mel coming over here, I just loved the lifestyle over here. I grew up regionally in New South Wales, so being a little bit smaller and slower than, say, Sydney or Melbourne, I just loved it, and coastal. So my only biggest challenge was when Mel finished her studies, after having I'd been here for 2 years, we then got married.
Yeah.
And I sort of held my breath, hoping that she'd happily settle here.
And was that a tough sell? Or
no, she loved
was on board.
What she saw whenever she visited.
Yeah.
But it was more for her career. But she came in and just set up her own. She's a dietitian, so she managed to set up her own private practice and flourished. And
beautiful.
So that was a very seamless transition. So away we were, and here we are 27 years later.
Mate, we're happy to call you one of our own now, well and truly. The call up to the Australian side, we're sort of fast tracking. I mean, I can only imagine it's a magical moment in anyone's career at that elite level. Tell us how that unfolded. Was it a phone call, an email? How did that happen?
Yeah, phone call back in those days.
Of course, sorry,
and, it's a while ago. but I'd sort of been, you know, I'd been through, fortunately, I'd been right down the pathway through under 17. Yeah. Australian cricket under 19s, and then Australia A, which was in and around at that stage, mid-90s.
Yep.
So I was sort of being tracked along and managing, using all those stepping stones as goals and objectives to try to achieve. And but then you get in and around there, and then you just, every time the phone rings, you're hoping that it's the call.
Yeah.
But Ian Healy was doing a great job. But and then I was put on standby a number of times in Test cricket, but as far as getting into my very first call into an Australian side, it was the Australian team were in India in 1996, and I wasn't part of the squad. The one day they played a one-off test, and then they were playing some one days. I was in the shower. Mel answered the phone, and it was the chairman of or the CEO of Cricket Australia at the time. Said, I need to speak to Adam. She said, oh, well, he's in the shower, I'll call you back. And said, no, go and get him.
So he's going to want to get it.
Yeah, so quick, standing there in a towel, dripping, going, hello. And, yeah, Heels had been injured. So they said, get on a plane. We need you get to India as quick as possible.
Yeah.
And it's like your world sort of changes. It gets flipped upside down because you've got to get, well, I had to go to a doctor and get some jabs to be able to then fly. You had to fly to Melbourne to get around here, there, and everywhere, but it just becomes a bit of a blur, really, because you're doing interview after interview after interview, but trying to pack a bag and then the excitement, you know, you barely
trying not to get overwhelmed by that.
About the game.
Yeah,
landed in Delhi at midnight. Went to the hotel room. Was rooming with Steve Waugh, who I'd barely met. Might have shaken hands with him once or twice. And then at 6:30 a.m. we were up on the bus on the road to go to this ground in a place called Faridabad, which is about an hour and a half drive out of Delhi. So it was all a blur, but it's that magical sort of feeling of and you just reflect on all the sacrifices and all the people that have helped you get there and have contributed to that journey.
Yeah. And the presentation of the baggy green also seems one of those moments too.
Who
put that on your head for the first time?
That then becomes, so that the India trip was the one dayers.
Mm.
And I then very fortunately played the best part of 2 years of one day cricket while Ian Healy was in the test team. And of course, it's the baggy green that you're in real pursuit of.
Mm.
So that came, it was almost deja vu. It happened at the Gabba. So I got booed all the way out onto the gate because Ian Healy had...
Because they really wanted him to have a farewell match.
A farewell test.
You robbed him of that.
Yeah, really. Well, I would have been happy for him. Yeah, there was no guarantee that that I was going to be the one that they would go to. But I remember leading into it and the debate was out there before the selection. I sort of thought, oh, he probably deserves it.
Yeah, but it's tough, isn't it? It's a reminder of how brutal it can be.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I got called in there and received my cap from a bloke called Bill Brown, who was a member of the 1948, a member of a number of Australian, very successful Australian test teams, but the Invincibles of 1948 is probably where that group's most remembered for, with Bradman and co. Bill was just the loveliest man. He's passed away now, but what a humble, lovely man.
Yeah. What did he say to you? Do you remember?
No, I just wear it with pride. Very exclusive club, if you like, and you know, acknowledge the hard work that every player that had ever received that cap had put in. And he assumed, I didn't know Bill prior to that, but he assumed that I was probably no different in working hard, but just to really enjoy it, but just try to just play for the team at all times. That was his main focus, and we had an amazing experience in the next test, in the second test down in Hobart, where we had four of those Invincibles with us for the whole test match at the test match dinner, and they just hung with us all game. And it was just really, really nice to have that generations prior passing on their knowledge and their humility. Mm. I just remember Bill and Arthur Morris just going, you guys are so good now. You're so much more athletic than us. You know, it was really like that whole... And that's not saying that's just an ego boost. It's nice to know that they're not going the other way, saying, oh, you weren't as good as us. And I've tried to always keep that in mind. I think that's a nice sort of legacy to leave behind, that things do improve, things change, and it's nice to acknowledge it.
Yeah, absolutely. We better acknowledge our sponsors as we take a quick break. Adam Gilchrist is our special guest. This is Inspiring Stories. We'll get into your test career right after we take a break. Back with more soon.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bower and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bower and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Tim McMillan is my name. My special guest is Adam Gilchrist. Gilly, we've probably not got enough time to reflect on all of your, your milestone innings. You mentioned a couple of them already, and I'd be a surprise to many to hear you say 49 in India was perhaps one of your most rewarding innings. But in terms of the centuries and those sort of crunch moments, are there any others that kind of stand out for you, you know, where you just felt like you were just seeing the ball like a football, or you were just at your absolute peak of your powers?
I think in the two different formats, although blended them in together the same way. I think there's probably the test match scenario. Probably the second test where I got my first 100. I mean, that you want to get to a level.
Yeah.
And then once you're there and you taste it, that's when you want to cement your spot and prove that you should be there and start contributing.
Yeah.
You know, really contributing to test match wins.
And for those, there are millions of cricket fans around the world who just are tragics for the game, who can only ever imagine what it's like to score a ton, to raise the bat, in front of a cheering crowd. If you can try to put that into words, like, what is that feeling like?
I mean,
what's going through you? What's going through your mind?
I think again, it's about the team. Like, I just think the overwhelming part of what I loved, my memories of scoring 100, the very first memory or the thing that pops into your mind is just to want to sort of look to your team. And I know when I'm in the change rooms and someone scores 100, it's just such a strong feeling of unity within a change room to be out there clapping and, you know, and cheering and sharing in that moment. So when you're the one out in the middle, and of course, if it's contributing to the team's situation, which generally, if you're scoring 100, it's probably a pretty more often than not a positive situation. Yeah. So yeah, there's that sharing in that moment and acknowledgement to each other, and then, of course, whether you've got family or friends there, but and then on top of all that is the added bonus if there's a crowd there, and the fact that, again, it's not not just the them cheering you, it's sharing that moment in its entirety, because, you know, if they're cheering you, that probably means that they're going for your team and you're helping them have a better experience too. So if that all makes sense, it's really just sharing that whole experience that you're all trying to achieve or hoping to see a certain direction of a game or a result, and you're a part of that and you've contributed to it. So it's everything that you would think it is and how you think it would feel if you're having that moment in front of a big audience.
Is it like a drug? You just want it again and again?
Yeah, it's certainly enough to keep you hungry. But whether it's the 100, you know, cricket is such a game of statistics. And we've always laugh about this in change rooms. What's the difference between 99 and 100? Yeah, it's one run, but it's a stat on your record that is indelibly marked forever. So, you know, if you're a batsman that scored, you know, if Sir Donald Bradman scored 29 99s and never got past that, is he great?
We wouldn't be talking about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he averaged 99. So, but I think just the feeling of contribution and then to sit down in, that's what I love about cricket and being a team sport. I love team sport because you sit down, whatever the sport is, you plan. You know, you do your analysis and then you plan and then you go out and try to execute those plans and hopefully achieve something, you know, as a combined unit. That's the most fulfilling achievement.
Yeah.
So then you celebrate together.
Yeah.
And equally, if it doesn't go well, you've got teammates to commiserate with and to learn from.
Yeah.
And that's probably the drug analogy. That's the you know, tasting something and just wanting more and more and more of it.
Well, you certainly had your fair share as a team of
very
success.
Good era.
And it seemed like you were able to celebrate a lot.
We did.
And tell me about, I mean, people love hearing the stories, don't they?
Yeah.
Like you guys, when you're having those celebratory moments on tour. I mean, I know you do a lot of public speaking and that sort of stuff, and people love hearing these cricket tales and reading books, you know, with all those cricket tales in them, you know, whether they're entirely true or not.
Yeah,
we
that's
love
right.
Them.
They get better and better with age.
What are your go-to stories that people just love hearing?
Yeah, I don't know. Everyone wants to hear about Warnie, but but there's not much we haven't heard or read about Warnie. But again, that my favourite recollections or memories are around the team dynamic and in the celebrations. We went through a period, as you say, we do the team song after a test win. So you're always in the change rooms. And then in amongst one of those runs of 16 test wins in a row, I think it was Ricky Ponting was the sort of custodian as the song master. And at the MCG, we beat the West Indies there in a test, the Boxing Day test, and Ricky said, right, we're going to do something different today. Like, we'd been in the change rooms for quite a few hours. So we're not going to do the song in the change rooms. We're going to do it somewhere. I'm going to take it on the road. All right, okay, where are we going to go? So we went to the top of the Great Southern Stand. So it was empty. The whole ground had been cleaned out by that stage. And it was just the 12 players, so the 11 plus 12th man and the coaching staff. And right at the top of the Great Southern Stand, take a couple of beers up there and then typically whoever's in charge of the song, in this case Ricky, would just go around and say a few words about maybe the man of the match or whatever he wanted to do. And then, bang, you just rip into this song. And that was spine-tingling, the echoing around the great MCG cauldron. And so that was really cool. So then from after that game on, it seemed we had to get a new spot every time, get more and more funky with it. Yeah. And we ended up about 12 months later in winning a test in Cape Town against South Africa. And we're in the change rooms, big celebration. It's got to about midnight, and we decide – we're going to take the team song up to top of Table Mountain,
which the
lift had been shut. The cable car had been shut for about 2 hours, but somehow we got a hold of someone that had the keys.
Really?
And up we go, up top
they
of Table Mountain.
They would have hated letting you up there too, wouldn't they?
Oh,
the locals.
They didn't mind it. They did pretty well. And up the top we went, and standing on the edge of this mountain, well, with a barrier there, but looking out all over Cape Town, which is a beautiful city.
Amazing.
But to be there and screaming out this song with so much passion and pride with your best mates, that was pretty unique feeling. So, there's been some really good fun celebrations.
Just before we move on to your post-professional playing days, if I could just pepper you with a few quick-fire questions.
Yep.
The bowler that you love to smash over the fence the most, or is there one bowler that you just took particular delight in sending, you know, 10 rows back?
Well, the name that comes to mind is Daniel Vittori, left-arm orthodox or left-arm finger spinner from New Zealand. One of the great blokes.
Yeah.
Love him. And his name comes to mind because he's the guy that I hit most of my sixes off. So I think I hit him for 17 sixes. So I just didn't mind his shape and his left arm just spinning into me. If I ever got in trouble, I could just swing across the line and hit with the spin. So there was nothing personal there. It wasn't like this aggressive streak against him.
You just lined up beautifully.
Yeah, but he was a very good bowler, but I got a hold of him, which was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Toughest bowler you faced?
Murali.
Yeah.
Yeah. Muralidharan from Sri Lanka. I just couldn't pick him. I had no idea which way the ball was going to spin.
No. And of course, you would have been there for that period of time when he was called.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I don't want to say a chucker, but his action deemed illegitimate.
Yep.
Your thoughts on that at the time?
Yeah, well, that got me in a bit of trouble, actually.
You were kind of on the Darryl Hare side of things, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I was at a Carlton Football Club lunch, of all places. Early 2000, might have been 2002, I reckon, June 2002, and John Elliott was the president then, and I was there as a guest, and then off the cuff, he said, "Oh, Gilly, would you mind come up and answer a few questions at the lunch?" And I went, "Oh, okay." So he was chatting about, did you play footy, and what was your love of Carlton from, and and then last question, he said, "And Murali, is he a chucker?" And I sort of looked around the room. There's 200 people at a private function, and I thought, So I foolishly sort of said, probably. If you look at the rules and read them, interpret them, I think he's probably out. So anyway, there was a journo there, wasn't there?
Of course there was.
Lit up. So that got me a hearing, bringing the game into disrepute from Australia. But
you did have a few people who backed
you, there's a few people. And whatever the case, I suppose the big story out of that is Murali was just doing what he was doing. So whether others lobbied to have rules change, and it was. I mean, the rules were changed about the 15 degrees, and because it was always deemed that the arm couldn't straighten at all, have any bend in it. But of course, it all changed. Murali went on to become the most successful bowler in history. Whether you think it was right or wrong, he was very skilled, highly skilled, and he had me guessing. I could not pick which way it was spinning. So sometimes I got a hold of him more through not luck, maybe a little bit of a match plan, but if he generally got me very early.
Yeah. The team that you love to beat the most?
The most satisfying victory was winning in India in 2004.
Yeah.
Australian team had been trying that for 35 years without success. Yeah. So that was, I think that was the absolute peak for that group of players.
Yeah. Best player that you played alongside?
Shane Warne.
Yeah.
Best all-round cricketer. Closely followed by Ricky Ponting. There's a list a mile long there.
Yeah, you can go on. It's a competitive list.
For Warney, for all-round cricketer, I mean, he's the best ever at leg spin at what he did. He was more than capable batsman. His numbers should have been a bit higher if he probably trusted himself a bit more there.
Yeah.
Fielder, 100-odd catches,
yeah.
Tactical nous.
Yeah.
And then on top of all that,
yeah.
The fame and the Hollywood nature and name.
Just all of it.
He was so much fun to play, beating around.
And last question before we go to another break.
Yep.
Your decision to walk when you felt like you'd been dismissed.
Yeah.
You went out on a limb there, didn't you? Because, you know, a lot of people didn't agree with you.
Yeah.
Some of your own teammates didn't agree with you. In hindsight, is that that's who you were as a person? You were true to who you were? No regrets about that?
I think the way you play the game probably reflects your, certainly your upbringing and your personality.
Yeah.
And the outside influences that you've had in that journey to get to that point. And more so probably at cricket at every level, not just at test level. I think even in club cricket, you see it played out. That doesn't mean for a moment that, and I had really strong values instilled in me from mum and dad.
Mm.
And I'd never forget that. And I'd, resort and refer back to them almost daily, I guess. But that doesn't mean if you don't walk that I sit there and judge you that you don't have strong values or can't trust you or that you're deceptive. Like, far from it. It is just such an amazing little nuance of cricket that you can stand there knowing you've hit it, umpire gives you not out, and the opposition can lose it and go bananas, but then everyone just gets on with it and understands why you're standing there.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you're just waiting for the umpire's decision. That's all you're doing, isn't it, if you don't walk.
Yeah.
So I understand that. But it probably flowed more from there was some stuff going on around the game as the rules were evolving about, close catches, if the ball had carried or not.
Mm.
And it was the introduction of third umpire technology to try to, the TV umpire and see if the camera picks it up. We as players are great whingers. We'll blame an umpire for a poor decision and blame a loss on an umpire over a poor decision. But if they gave a decision in your favour that saw you win, we would never go and say, oh, well done, mate, that was perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you. Like we loved it one-way traffic, but not the
exactly.
other. So I think somewhere in my mind, I was starting to think we as players could probably take a bit more ownership of this and maybe just eliminate one area where an error could have been made. Just get on with it. And you hit it, just get off. But I wasn't on a campaign or a crusade. It's just each
because it was sort of painted as such, wasn't it?
Well, because it came up in a World Cup semi-final, I think, that had the microscope of the cricketing world on it, and it garnered a lot of opinion, garnered a lot of eyeballs watching it, and that probably sort of magnified it more than other people have walked in history.
Yep. We need to take another break. After that, we'll talk about all the things you've been up to since you put the gloves down and the bat down.
Yep.
Plenty to get through. This is Inspiring Stories with Gilly. Back with more in a minute.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. We are hearing the inspiring story of Adam Gilchrist. Gilly, when did you know it was time to finish up?
When I dropped a catch at the Adelaide Oval off the bowling of Brett Lee.
Yep.
It was a pretty easy catch. Watched the replay. They replayed about 40 times up on the big screen. But something told me. I just realised in my mind I was just a fraction of a second behind where I needed
just
to be.
Just lost your edge a little bit.
And, it wouldn't have been obvious to anyone else.
Yeah.
But that triggered realisation that at training, whilst I wasn't wishing it away, I was happy to be at training, but my mind was often towards the end thinking about either a sponsor's commitment or a family. If I had Mel and the kids on tour with me, going and doing something with Dan, and it just wasn't as sharp as what I needed to be. And as soon as I realised that, I thought, nah, I'm not going to try and ride this for another year or two.
Yeah.
That's good enough for me.
Yeah. And yet, I suppose even towards the back of your career, the sort of money that was being pumped into the game that prolonged a lot of people's careers, didn't they? Stints in the IPL that went on well beyond the end of people's, careers at the national setup. Was it tempting to drag it out for as long as
you could?
You did a bit, but
I cashed in.
Like the money that suddenly became available was phenomenal, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I'd committed to the very first IPL
Yeah.
Just before that realisation.
Yeah.
And it was a few weeks after that they had the first auction of the IPL. So I thought, look, I better honour that first year's commitment. And it was, I'm glad I did, because the IPL was phenomenal. What an amazing experience. All these different nationalities. And we didn't know if it was going to be what you term Mickey Mouse cricket and sort of almost hit and giggle. And but as soon as we got there, we realised that is quality, a quality concept and tournament. And it's just grown and grown and grown. But I played the first six after I'd finished playing full international cricket. And it was magical. Really, really fulfilling experience. And there's good money thrown around then. I mean, that was ridiculous money for the time then, and now it's even more extraordinary. But I was never going to try and drag the journey out. I'd turn my focus to a few other things outside of the game.
You seemed to transition pretty seamlessly into a media role. Was that something that started to sort of take shape in your mind towards the end of your playing days, that, hey, this could be what I do?
Yeah, not really. I was sort of afforded an opportunity to join that Channel 9, you know, that legendary commentary crew straight away if I wanted to. But I did one test match here at Perth straight in the first year out of the game. And it just, I don't know, it just didn't feel like it was me at all. Maybe it was too soon. Maybe it was in the commentary box with those guys that were just legends, you know, Tony Gregg, Richie Beno, Bill Laurie, that it was a bit daunting. But I said no thanks, and I didn't get into that section of my post-career career being broadcasting for about 5 years until Channel 10 picked up the Big Bash, and they did need to literally build a new team. So when I found out, that that was going to be with Ricky Ponting, Mark Waugh and Damien Fleming, who were great mates, I thought, yeah, I'll give that a go.
Yeah.
So that was fun. So that's where that was born from. So I was fortunate to have some really nice partnerships, relationships with sponsors and organisations that were initially as part of while I was playing, but they carried over into post-career life. So I had a nice soft landing. I didn't sort of jump off the freight train that was cricket and be left standing there watching everything fly by and going, what's next? So that was a nice transition.
Who are the players now that you most love to watch and commentate?
I love Rishabh Pant from India.
Yeah.
I see a style that he plays with it. I think I tried to carry out in the Australian setup. David Warner's always been fantastic to watch. Pat Cummins is an absolute superstar. I could watch him.
I mean,
fast bowlers running in has always been exciting, but I've probably always been drawn more to the batting side of it. But to watch him bowl is just so exciting. And then, you know, through that IPL, any number of superstars, be they local Indians or all the big names that go there. AB De Villiers was just so creative.
I know too, you've turned your attention towards charitable roles as well. I know you've been involved with World Vision.
Yep.
For instance, what drew you to that? Because I understand it's a particular connection to India.
To India. That's where that they sort of inquired, would I like to, we always, from growing up, always had a sponsored child through World Vision. That's from when I was little. I remember mum and dad being part of that program. But so they asked if I would take that on, a role to help support their work in India. So that was fantastic, going and visiting some of the programs, educational programs, and providing opportunities for young boys and girls to transition out of pretty much out of primary school into almost into industry, really, and doing it and being acknowledged and skilled up and paid for it, potentially earning a living and giving them that opportunity to grow. But more locally here, been patron of Ronald McDonald House for 21 years. So that's the charity. So many wonderful charitable organisations out there. Try to help out where you can, but that's the one that I've sort of aligned myself to, and that's been a wonderful experience that you get more out of than what you probably chip in.
I imagine you get a lot of invitations to be involved with all sorts of extremely worthy charities.
Yeah.
But you can't play a role with all of them, can you? Is that hard to sort of have to, you know, choose one over another?
It is, but you don't want to dilute the message of what they're trying to achieve. So I have said sort of, no, I can't do this because of time. And you're trying to balance everything up, but I want to make sure I can maintain my commitment to Ronald McDonald House and also allow whatever the other charity might be to get someone that can then concentrate their time on that one to give it the best opportunity.
Yep, And just finally, goals going forward. Are you someone that makes long-term plans and then and works?
Not sure what I'm going to do when I grow up. I'm still trying to work that out. But yeah, we've got kids, you know, age range from 19 to 9. So we're sort of got a full book there. But as they move more and more towards adulthood, you know, I'm not sure where I'll go. But I love that. I think that's part of what's kept me inspired all the way through the journey. Going back to moving here, the question you asked right at the start about coming to WA and what did the crowd sort of animosity do to you? And it's just the fear of it's the unknown ahead. And I think that inspires you just to keep working, keep the eyes wide open and identify opportunities.
Yeah. Gilly, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story, and thank you for providing us with hours of cricket highlights to watch over and over in the archives. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Inspiring Stories here on 882 6PR in this episode with the one and only Adam Gilchrist. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. We look forward to you joining us next time as we unearth another inspiring story.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.